You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Wisconsin Dells is home to a new museum celebrating the history of root beer. We'll talk with the people behind the museum about what's on display and how Wisconsin helped make root beer famous. First, the upcoming two-year state budget is now in the hands of the full legislature. The Republican-controlled Joint Finance Committee finished its work last week. It approved a $3.4 billion tax cut made up of income and property tax deductions. Democrats aren't too keen on the idea, insisting that the money would be better spent on schools, broadband, and other things. Republicans also approved a plan to increase state support for public schools, along with a 2% raise for state workers. After the Assembly and the Senate get done with the budget, it goes to Governor Tony Evers. What questions do you have about what's happening? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Right now, we've got Sean Johnson, who is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Keeley.
Overall, this budget plan passed by the Joint Finance Committee, it's big, and it doesn't look a whole lot like what Governor Tony Evers came out with a few months ago, right?
I think that is very safe to say, yeah. I mean, pretty much the first vote that the legislature's budget committee took removed more than 380 of Governor Tony Evers' proposals from the budget and also basically set the framework for how they were going to proceed, which is they were going to build their budget based off of what was signed 2 years ago rather than what Governor Tony Evers introduced earlier this year. Kind of just followed from there and on to their last day of votes, which left you with a budget that was a lot different than what the governor wanted.
This proposed tax cut is grabbing some headlines. The money for this comes from projected tax revenues that are better than we anticipated, announced earlier this month. What's the breakdown of what Republicans want to do here?
They want to cut a variety of taxes. The biggest tax cut in terms of dollars would be an income tax cut. And this is using these revenue projections that came out from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau showing that because economic activity has really surged since the last time we had revenue estimates, the state's got about $4.4 billion more than expected over the next couple of years. And so this GOP tax cut has an income tax cut for people who earn between about $24,000 and $263,000, or families that earn between $32,000 and $350,000. So really broad range there. And it would lower the taxes in that bracket from 6.27% to 5.3%. That coupled with some other targeted income tax cuts, and you're looking at about $2.7 billion there. They also want to lower property taxes, and they want to phase out the personal property tax on equipment that businesses own. So all that together is around $3.4 billion.
And what are Democrats' hangups with this plan?
If you look at the way that it is structured, because they're going at this one income bracket, which includes people who don't make a lot to, people who make a few hundred thousand dollars, they're saying that it's going to be bringing a lot of income tax relief to people who make a lot of money. And, the Fiscal Bureau's breakdown of how this applies to different incomes kind of bears that out in terms of the dollars and where they're going. They also are unhappy with the way that Republicans are prioritizing this tax cut instead of increasing school funding. In fact, part of what they did on the last day of budget votes was they devoted more state money to the school funding formula. But because of the way the state school funding formula is structured, they didn't increase revenue limits. And because of that, it effectively just applies that money to a property tax cut rather than sending it to classrooms. So I think those are some of the major gripes that Democrats have with the plan and, why they didn't vote for it in the budget committee and have given no indications that they plan to vote for it when it's up in the legislature.
And it does go to the full legislature before moving to Governor Evers' desk. Do you anticipate that there will be major changes on the floor?
In practice, Republicans have really treated the Joint Finance Committee as the place where they build their budget. It doesn't mean that they won't make some changes. I mean, sometimes you get a group of lawmakers together, like in the Senate especially. You could get, four or five Senate Republicans who decide they want to kind of lay down the law here and make a change to the budget. They can group together and refuse to pass it unless they get what they want. Stuff like that happens. But by and large, I think what you see is what you're going to get when it comes out of the full legislature, unless the governor sits down and negotiate something different with legislative leaders, but they have not gotten along so well.
Sean, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief with that quick recap of the budget plan that has passed through the Joint Finance Committee. And now for some insight on what that powerful committee budget would do and how it might change before the process is over, we go to Anthony Chergovsky. He's an assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. Anthony, good to have you with us.
Hi, Keeley. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's pick up as we left off with Sean. What are your thoughts on where the budget stands at this moment?
Certainly the eye-popping aspect of it is the $3.4 billion proposed in tax cuts over the next 2 years. As Sean noted, most of that is targeted toward state income tax reduction, that big tax bracket that covers so many Wisconsinites. But what is also notable here is the politics of education. And the one-time influx in education spending that is coming from the federal government via the COVID-19 relief legislation. Now, Republicans, as Sean mentioned, have essentially kept education spending flat, noting that this huge influx of education spending is coming from the federal government, so there's really no need, from their point of view, to increase education funding. Democrats say that's the wrong way to look at this, that this is one-time spending, this is one-time money coming in from the federal government, and that the state needs to pick up more of the tab when it comes to education funding.
And we should also note that the Republican proposal, the money that it gives schools over the next 2 years, is a fraction of the $1.6 billion that Governor Tony Evers proposed. So that's another example that we can see where the governor and Republican lawmakers are just in different places. This is certainly not the first time Republicans have proposed cutting taxes. How do you weigh the significance of this particular plan?
I think that this is going to be complicated politics for Tony Evers. We have to remember the timeline here, in that Tony Evers is entering his reelection campaign, facing the voters in November of 2022. I think the Republicans understand that it will be difficult for Tony Evers, who will be soon facing the voters, it will be difficult for him to turn down a tax cut of this magnitude. Certainly, this isn't the kind of tax cut that Tony Evers would have designed if he could do it on his own. Like Sean said, the Democrats are complaining about how this tax cut really does benefit the higher earners. Most of the benefits would go towards those who make over $100,000 a year. But you also have to consider the politics and the election politics of this. And that's why I ultimately expect Tony Evers to sign this budget into law, of course, making significant use of his very powerful partial line item veto power.
Sure. So he can make adjustments within the budget without actually throwing out the entire budget, although that is also on the table for him.
That is also on the table for him. I do think the likely outcome here is that both the state assembly and the state senate will pass the budget early next week, like Sean said, probably with minimal modifications. And then it'll go to Governor Evers. I expect that Governor Evers will make significant use of the line item veto, ultimately concluding this budget process. And then already we gear up for election 2022.
still on the tax cut idea, Republicans and Democrats really have different ideas on what to do with the extra money that's supposed to come in because of those bigger tax revenues. Republicans want to cut the taxes, and Democrats are saying we should invest that money in other things. Explain the philosophical differences here.
Sure. It's worth noting that this news about the stronger than expected tax revenues completely changed the politics of this budget process. This news that there was this surge in tax revenues resulting in the state expected to take in $4.4 billion over the next 3 years, that completely upended the politics of this budget process. And Keeley, to your point, it really highlighted the differences between the two parties in terms of their issue priorities and in terms of how they view the role of government. Certainly, it did not take long for Republican leaders to start calling for tax reductions after the news of the stronger than expected tax revenues came out. Meanwhile, you had the Democrats talking about more funding for the UW system, more funding for technical schools, more funding for K-12. It really highlights the significant gap between the two parties, both in what issues they prioritize, kind of what their first instincts were when the news of the strong revenue forecast came out, and also just their difference in how they view the role of government as well.
We're getting an update on the state budget as the full state legislature prepares to take it up. Anthony Chergosky is our guest. He's an assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse. You can join in. There's a line for you now at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the budget? How do you feel about the billions of dollars in proposed tax cuts? Do you think that money should go primarily towards schools or other priorities instead? Share what particular item you're deeply concerned about at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. This conversation is not over. Stick with us here on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. The Wisconsin Legislature's Joint Finance Committee finished its budget work last week after Republicans on the panel approved a $3.4 billion tax cut. Democrats say that money would be better spent going to K-12 education or other things. Next up, the State Assembly and the State Senate will vote on the budget. Then it goes to Governor Evers. Right now, we're talking about it on Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Anthony Chergosky is our guest. He's an assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Daniel in Milwaukee on the line. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. I mean, I'm really excited about, you know, the fact that we have this federal funding available for K-12. I'm pleased at the direction the legislature is going with it. I think that the danger of taking money from these trillions of dollars of stimulus and pumping them into our schools is that, you know, in the next budget cycle, Wisconsinites are going to have to backfill that themselves. Because these government spending programs continuously expand. So in 2 years, we could see how our economic recovery is, and I'd love to put more money into K-12 schools, but we're already going to be paying for this for decades. We might as well use this federal money for our schools right now.
Daniel, thank you so much for weighing in on this. And Anthony, Daniel is bringing up that concept of one-time dollars from the federal government and how Wisconsin schools cope with that if it's part of the calculation for the next 2 years.
Right. And to Daniel's point, the Democrats really do see this as a missed opportunity because you have, as we've talked about, that surge in tax revenues, what the Legislative Fiscal Bureau has called an unprecedented increase in tax collections. And the Democrats really see that as an opportunity to make kind of like once in a generation style investments in these programs like K-12 and tech schools, the UW system. And, you know, Daniel makes a good point. What happens 2 years down the road when these federal funds are no more? This is not a sustainable form of spending by any stretch. What happens after the federal spending is gone? What will the state's approach be to funding education if it is, as it seems it will, be leaning so heavily for the next 2 years on these one-time federal dollars.
Yeah, to those ongoing expenses, or maybe one-time expenses. I guess it depends on how the schools spend that money. We've got Tina in Kenosha, who also wants to join in on this conversation. Tina, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Yes, I believe that in the first part of the conversation, you said that the budget was said that they would also increase their wages. I'm not sure if that's true or not, if I heard that correctly. However, what we need to do with that money that we are getting, we need to invest. We need to invest in the future, just like the President of the United States is trying to do right now. Because if we don't, I don't know about anybody else, but I drive on the Wisconsin roads and they are horrific. So, I'm not sure that if they do indeed want to increase their wages, that tax cutting, wage increases, is this just a Republican thing or am I crazy? Thanks a lot.
Tina, thanks for bringing this up and, you know, mentioning infrastructure and also wondering about the give and take. They are proposing an increase in state employee salary raises that was approved within the plan. And we can talk about the Wisconsin university system ahead, too. But what about this idea that it's a good time to invest? Anthony, do you see that in the budget from Republicans?
You know, Keeley, this does really seem to be a budget that leans more on tax cutting as opposed to investing. The headline here, the eye-popping figure that we've been talking about, that $3.4 billion in tax cuts over 2 years, that is what the Republicans want to really tout. That is what Republicans want to sell coming out of this budget process, sell as their major accomplishment. So I think that the Republicans are going to come out of this really looking at their changes to the tax system as a big win for them, both in how they are lowering one of the state's income tax brackets from 6.27% down to 5.3%, and how they are providing schools and tech colleges with more state funding, but that is to be offset by reductions in the property tax, ultimately leaving funding steady with no increase for K-12 or the tech schools.
Well, and Tina mentioned things like investing in roads, right? But is one of the Republican arguments that when you return tax dollars to the people who paid them in, then they will spend them, and that's a different kind of investment?
I think so, Keeley. And you are seeing how the politics at the federal level are affecting politics at the Wisconsin state level. The COVID relief package that devoted so much money to schools has had a profound effect on this budget process in terms of the debates and the deliberations surrounding school funding. And I also think that some uncertainty about the infrastructure package currently being debated in Congress is also affecting this process. This process is going to conclude before we know really what happens at the federal level when it comes to the infrastructure package. So I think that one might say the legislature is holding its fire a bit on infrastructure with the assumption that the federal government might be coming in to take action of its own in that area.
We're talking with Anthony Chergosky, who's an assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. And we're talking about the budget as it is approved by GOP lawmakers now that it moves to the full state legislature and then eventually moves to the governor's desk. You're listening to the Ideas Network, and this is Central Time. The University of Wisconsin system we mentioned, it would get a bump of $8.25 million under this Republican budget. That's compared to $192 million that Evers proposed. The 8-year UW tuition freeze would also come to an end under the GOP plan. What do you expect to happen with the UW system piece in this final budget?
Yeah, Keely, I think that it was a bit of a surprise to me to see the tuition freeze come to an end, because Republicans have long touted the tuition freeze as being a signature accomplishment or one of the key accomplishments of the Scott Walker era. So I was a bit surprised to see the Joint Finance Committee discard that. When it comes to funding the UW system, I think this reveals the incredible gap between Governor Evers, what he proposed for education spending, and what the Republicans on the Joint Finance Committee are offering. There is a massive gap in the proposals, both at the K-12 level, at the tech schools level, and at the UW system level when it comes to education funding. No shock, given the icy, to put it mildly, the icy relationship between Governor Evers and legislative Republicans, that there would be such an enormous gap between the two sides.
As you see the budget work through the process we've got, what are you watching?
I'm watching how Tony Evers looks at the end game here, because he's going to have to sell this budget, assuming he signs it into law and assuming that he makes significant use of the line item veto. I expect him to do both. I expect him to sign this budget, and I expect him to make substantial use of the very powerful line item veto that Wisconsin governors are given. And then it becomes a task of selling this to the public as he goes into his 2022 reelection campaign. Not the budget that he would have designed. We know that, because this is not at all the budget that he presented at the beginning of this process, but he'll sign it into law, presumably. He'll make some line item vetoes, and then he'll have to sell it as an achievement going into his reelection contest.
Thanks for bringing the politics back home for us, Anthony. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Anthony Chergosky is an assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. We talked with him about the state budget and what to expect as the full legislature prepares to take it up. Earlier, we heard from WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. And one quick note, Republicans on the budget committee also voted to approve a 2% raise for state workers on January 1st, 2022 and 2023. We mentioned that earlier. And we should note that Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Coming up here on Central Time, we'll explore one of Wisconsin's newest museums, the Museum of Root Beer. I'm Keely Voltina. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Voltina in for Rob Verrett. This is Central Time. Coming up, nothing says summer quite like the local ice cream or custard stand. What flavor do you reach for? We'll be taking your suggestions for the best ice cream flavors out there. And you can get us started now by posting over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. First, when it comes to brewed beverages that Wisconsin is famous for, you probably think of beer. But we're no slouch when it comes to root beer either. And now the Wisconsin Dells is home to a new museum celebrating the history of root beer and some of the local brands that made their mark over the years. Reed Andrew is the owner of Root Beer Revelry and the Museum of Root Beer. Reed, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
And also with us is Vince Payne. He's co-owner of the museum, and he's been gathering root beer-related items since he was 11 years old. His collection is on display. Vince, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Reed, let's start here. You worked with Vince and his collection to get this museum going. What got you into root beer as a thing, not just a drink that you might choose?
Well, The story that I can't resist telling is growing up reading the Peanuts comic strip and seeing Snoopy throwing back root beers in Woodstock's nest or on his doghouse or pretending he's a World War I flying ace. And it, for some reason, it made root beer cool to a young mind like mine.
So Snoopy wooed you into the root beer realm.
He was Joe Cool. So he made root beer cool, and I eventually discovered that I could tell one brand from another when I tasted them. And then in college, I started collecting cans and bottles, and it just became an obsession from there.
And you just, where did you keep the cans and bottles if you started collecting them?
Well, they started collecting on the top of the refrigerator. And later on in college, I was married, and my wife, Amy, just loved to see them collecting in the living room. And eventually, I think they went to the garage, and it's just been a management challenge for collecting these old cans and bottles, but so much fun.
We are talking about a new root beer museum in Wisconsin Dells that celebrates so much of more than 2,000 brands of root beer throughout a 135-year history of the drink being available commercially. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking with Reed Andrew, who's the owner of the Museum of Root Beer and Root Beer Revelry. And ahead, we will be talking with Vince Payne, who has been collecting root beer memorabilia and has that on the display at the museum. And Reed, what do we know about the origins of root beer and how it developed into its current form?
Well, it's such an American drink, but settlers from Europe came with their own recipes of brewing medicinal teas, they used to call them, T-E-A. And Native Americans had their recipes and ingredients also. So this drink has its roots, no pun intended, going way, way, way back.
And what role does Wisconsin play in this history? Are there brands that hold a special spot?
Yeah, in the museum, we have a tasting bar, and you can visit us and really get a taste of Wisconsin and Midwest root beers. The brewers, the traditional breweries in Wisconsin, have taken upon themselves to develop gourmet sodas, and root beer being one of the chief beverages. So, yeah, we have six Midwest root beers on tap, Sprecher, Point, Bloomers, 1919 from over in Minnesota. So it's a real Midwest taste test.
And you mentioned that you could taste the difference there. All root beers are not made the same. There are different flavor profiles out there. Is there a type of flavor you really gravitate toward, Reed?
Well, for me, it's got to be cold. It's got to be sharply carbonated. And for flavor, though, I like pure cane sugar as a sweetener and some vanilla in there. I like the creaminess.
And, you know, we're going to be talking about ice cream just ahead. What are your thoughts on a root beer float?
Oh, it's so good. And we serve floats right off the taps. And we also invite people to explore different types of floats, like a key lime soda over vanilla, or an orange cream soda. You can really make a float out of a lot of the gourmet sodas that we carry.
Oh, fun. All right, so Vince, what about you on the root beer float front? Is it a nice root beer treat that feeds into you know, your love of root beer, or does it take away something from the drink?
No, I think it adds to it. I probably have always gravitated more toward a root beer float made with a soft serve vanilla ice cream. Is kind of I just like that better. I think it tends to blend better, and the last bit of the floats just be the best. But you know, as long as it's a good quality vanilla ice cream, vanilla bean ice cream, and of course, you know, a very good root beer on top of it. There's so many to choose from. So I think it really brings out the uniqueness of a root beer when you make it into a float, in addition just to trying different root beers and profiling different root beers and tastes and flavors, which I've always enjoyed.
And Vince, I understand you started collecting things related to root beer as a kid.
Yes. When I was 11 years old, I started my root beer collection, although I had root beer earlier than that. As Reed mentioned, 1919 from Minnesota was one of my first root beers that I ever tasted when I traveled up there. My mother's side of the family and my mother was born up there. And so that was a staple visiting up, you know, the grandparents and having 1919 root beer. That was my first venture into root beer. So I always loved that that flavor. And then obviously when I was 11, I started collecting bottles and some of them were root beer. And as the museum highlights, talking about my start in the collection, I had a bunch of bottles, some broke, and the only two that survived was two root beer bottles, which I still have. And that started the journey. And then as I grew up older and started traveling around for work, started realizing there's other root beers out there from other states and other cities and towns. And I'd go to stores and buy them and try them and bring them home. And that just started me collecting bottles and cans. And then that led into starting to collect other things when my wife found some odd things that I never thought about collecting. And then the collection grass roots took off from there and just started collecting anything and everything root beer for the past 41 years.
And Vince, were you like Reed and used them to decorate your living room, or where does your collection live before so much of it wound up in this museum of root beer?
Well, for the longest time, the collection was in boxes and just stored because I had no place to ever display them, you know, growing up in you know, apartments and rental places and stuff. I never really had a place to display them until I bought my first house. And then I put all the cans and bottles out on display in the garage for the first time. And then I had to pack them all away when we did a remodel, and they got stored for another 4 or 5 years of everything. And then I bought my second house, and I finally had a whole basement to put everything out on display. And that's when I realized how much I had and how much I still needed to get. And then literally turned the whole entire first level of my house basement into a museum of itself. And that's where it started.
Yeah. And now it is in the Museum of Root Beer. And Reed, what do you want people to think about or to feel when they check out the Museum of Root Beer?
Well, it's a piece of Americana. You'll hear that. And one of our slogans is everybody has a root beer story. It's pretty much unfailing that somebody has a connection from their early life. Or from their childhood, and a brand that they really relate to, or a memory of going to the drive-in, or their grandparents making homemade root beer at home from an extract. And I hope that people come to the museum and reconnect with those memories and realize what a rich history root beer has as part of America. And we'll throw Canada in there because North America is really the main geographical place where people enjoy root beer the most.
All right, we'll bring Canada along with us. Reed and Vince, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Reed Andrew is the owner of Root Beer Revelry and the Museum of Root Beer in Wisconsin Dells. Co-owner Vince Payne's collection of items is on display there. It's open from 11 to 6 daily, and you can find out more at museumofrootbeer.com. And perhaps a conversation about root beer has you thinking about floats. We're talking ice cream next. What's your favorite flavor? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. And as we get your calls ready to share about ice cream, let's take a listen to This Wisconsin Life. This month marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. Here's Wisconsin Life host Maureen McCollum sharing a story for Father's Day. It's WPR producer Brad Colbert's pick for his favorite Wisconsin Life story.
Learning to ride a bike can be a milestone in a person's life. Lately, WPR producer and local dad, Brad Kohlberg, has been thinking about when he first learned how to ride a bike, teaching his daughter to ride, and what biking has meant to his family over the years, all because of a song he recently heard.
There is a band that I've followed on and off since college called Pedro the Lion, and they released a new song a while back called Yellow Bike. It's about getting your first bike and how the world opens up when you learn to ride it. It was a blast of nostalgia for me. It made me think of my first bike, my dad helping me learn to ride, me helping my daughter, and how important bike rides have been for my family over the years.
On a desert Christmas morning, 1981.
I got my first bike on my 6th birthday, a red Murray brand with chrome handlebars and chunky black tires. A bike for popping wheelies and doing sweet jumps. I loved it.
My first two-wheel bicycle stood by the tree. My heart thumping in my chest. Though I tried, I couldn't ride one yet.
The other neighborhood kids rode their bikes around in a little pack all day, and I really wanted to join. But I was embarrassed of the training wheels. So I begged, and my dad took them off, and I ran around pushing my bike beside me, trying to keep up with him. I couldn't.
Out on a street when my dad let go of the seat.
During practice sessions, my dad ran alongside me, gave me a nudge and let go of the seat. I'd coast, try to pedal, crash into the neighbor's mailbox. I even ran over my little brother one day when he wandered into my path and I couldn't steer around him. Sorry, Dave.
But I remember what it was like astride my yellow bike. First freedom, second life, all the places I could ride.
A friend had a bike that was smaller than mine, and my feet could easily touch the ground when I sat on it, which made it easier to coast. I'd ease down my driveway on his bike with my feet dangling to see how far I could go. One afternoon, I put my feet up and started pedaling. And I took off. I was riding. I still feel a little sad that my dad was at work when it finally happened. Sorry, Dad. But I didn't look back. The neighborhood became infinite. A motocross track, a battlefield, a movie set. All the money I made at my first job picking sweet corn went to building better bikes for bigger jumps. And I spent every summer day riding around town with my friends until I got to high school, when it became kid stuff, like overnight. My BMX gathered dust and was forgotten. Fast forward 25 years, and I was running beside my daughter in the church parking lot up the street as she learned to ride her first bike.
Okay, you ready? One, two, three. Go, go, go!
I gave her a nudge, let go of the seat, and watched her pull away from me and turn the corner out of sight. Now she's almost 14, and my old bag of tricks doesn't really work anymore. Legos, backyard baseball, trips to the playground. But she still rides around the neighborhood with me after dinner.
Dad, how long have you been videoing?
We talk a lot while we ride, and sometimes we keep the conversation going with some ice cream afterward. It's the greatest. So when I heard that Pedro the Lion song, you know what I did? I went out and got myself a new BMX bike. A bike for popping wheelies and doing sweet jumps. Because sometimes dads and kids aren't that different. And I feel like a kid when I ride it, with my daughter beside me. It's the greatest.
I trade my kingdom for someone to ride with.
Brad Kohlberg is a producer for WPR in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to Central Time. Next up, we want to hear from you. What is your favorite or one of your favorite ice cream or custard flavors? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. Maybe you wanted to talk about the toppings or maybe an alternative to ice cream. Now is the time. The number again is 800-642-1234. We're talking about it next here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Later on the network, we have 1A+. Few players can take their sport and professional sport to a whole new level. Serena Williams has. She's an icon who's still playing and influencing millions on and off the court. We've got author Gerald Maserati, who talks about his book called Seeing Serena. That's this evening at 6 o'clock. Now, this is Central Time. Yesterday was the first official day of summer, the unofficial season of eating cold treats like ice cream or custard for us Midwesterners. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your go-to ice cream or custard flavor? Are you more of a dish or a cone person? In a perfect world, what toppings would you get on your ice cream? Maybe you've got a strange ice cream flavor that you've tried and you want to tell us about it. Now's the time. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. One of our producers, Natalie, has childhood memories of the crunch cones from Dairy Queen. She looks forward to getting one of those this summer. And we've got Hannah from Ashland on the line. Hey, Hannah.
Hi.
So you have something to say about ice cream?
Yeah, I'm a big Rocky Road fan. I think you don't really need any toppings for Rocky Road. I think it comes with enough as it is. Put it in a cone and you got something good.
So what is it about Rocky Road? Because it's usually what, like chocolate ice cream and it has to have the marshmallows in it. What's the deal for you?
Totally the marshmallows, because you get that extra like sweetness in there with the chocolate. It's just good. A little sit around the campfire.
Have you had any yet this summer?
No, not yet. I'm going to get to it, hopefully.
That sounds great. Hannah, thank you so much for calling in and declaring Rocky Road the best when it comes to your perspective. You can join Hannah and call 800-642-1234. Maybe you are a hard scoop or a soft serve ice cream person. What flavor of the day do you look forward to? We have time for your call now, 800-642-1234. We did post this on our Ideas Network Facebook page and got a few different comments. We've got Doll, who says Blue Moon is the top choice there. I will admit that I had not heard of or tried Blue Moon until about 4 years ago, and I'm kind of lukewarm on the flavor. It's an okay flavor, but the kid in me is still very, very happy that it turns my tongue blue. So I'll give you that one. Blue Moon for the win. Sam says peanut butter swirl. I know a lot of people like peanut butter or caramel mixed into their ice cream. So perhaps you're one of those. Give us a call. Share your story, your opinions on ice cream or custard. There's a difference at 800-642-1234. Central Time producer Rachel says it always takes her a full 5 to 10 minutes of staring at the different ice cream flavors to decide. And then in the end, she always gets cookies and cream anyway. She also prefers the spoon cup combo and says cones are just a waste of time. Rachel, you and my daughter can chat because she tolerates the ice cream to get to the cone. So perhaps we could work something out there and figure it out. Maybe we can find some common ground. We also have Kathy on Facebook, who says iced la-di-da from Chocolate Shop is a great one. Kathy, thanks for sharing that. And it sounds like Jesse in Appleton wants to join our conversation about ice cream now. Hey, Jesse.
Hi. I live in Appleton now, but as a child, I lived in Tucson, Arizona. And there was a little dime store called Thrifty's. I guess it was all over the Southwest. But my favorite flavor, I was just tickled pink when we would go because they served square ice cream scoops.
What?
Yes, it was served in square little, they had an ice cream scoop maker and it was a square scoop. And it was a quarter for a one scoop, and it was rainbow sherbet was my favorite. Yes, and you can find the square scoops online. They're made in Germany now, and that is on my thing for my bucket list. I want a square scoop.
Oh, how fun. Jesse, thank you so much for sharing that story about ice cream and what an incredible memory that has for you. And let's go ahead and take Lou from La Crosse now, too. Hey, Lou.
Hi. So at the beginning of COVID, I bought myself an industrial ice cream maker, and I have since mastered 17 different flavors and have become incredibly popular with all my neighbors.
I bet. Oh, Lou, I love it. 17 different flavors. That is pretty incredible. Do you have a favorite, or is it like picking a favorite child?
Well, the maple with the candied praline pecans in it is one of my favorites.
Lou, thank you so much for describing that, and good luck, and we're very glad that you've become incredibly popular with everyone around you. I know a friend of mine, Carla, asked for an ice cream maker for Christmas, and she is also very, very popular with people. So maybe that is a good option for the future. Thanks to everyone who called in to share their favorite frozen custard and ice cream flavors. If you didn't get on the air, fear not. Still time to make your favorite flavor known on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. Then the Supreme Court issued several major decisions during the last week. We'll talk with an expert on the court about what we heard from the justices. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.